A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and the timing couldn't be better. Shavuot starts Thursday night, May 21st. Most people know it as the Cheesecake Holiday, the all-night study sessions, the blintzes. But here's the thing, none of that is biblical. The dairy, the Torah marathon, that's all medieval and later. What we're actually looking at is an ancient harvest festival, built around a very specific grain calendar. And the question Daniel's asking cuts right to it. In biblical times, would barley have been enjoyed alongside wheat? And what did the original Shavuot actually look like before 2,000 years of tradition layered on top of it?
The blintzes are doing a lot of heavy lifting in the popular imagination.
Covering the crops.
So let's strip it back. In the Torah, Shavuot has two names. Chag HaShavuot, the festival of weeks, and Chag HaKatzir, the festival of the harvest. That second name tells you everything. This is not a revelation holiday. It's a grain holiday. Exodus 23:16 and Deuteronomy 16:9-12 lay it out. You count 7 weeks from when the sickle first hits the standing grain, and then you celebrate.
When the sickle first hits the grain, that's the barley harvest, right? That's the starting gun.
The count begins with the omer, a sheaf of barley, waved in the temple on the second day of Passover. Leviticus 23, verses 10 and 11. That's day 1 of the count. Then you count 49 days, 7 complete weeks, and on the 50th day you bring the Shtei Halechem, 2 loaves of leavened wheat bread, as a wave offering. That's Shavuot.
The whole thing is bookended by grain. Barley opens the season, wheat closes it. That's not a metaphor. That's an agricultural calendar with a ritual strapped to it.
The ritual is specific in ways that most people miss. The omer on Passover is barley. Barley matures faster. It's the first grain ready to harvest in the spring. Wheat takes longer, needs more warmth, more sun. By the time Shavuot arrives in late May or early June, the wheat is at its peak. So the festival literally tracks the ripening cycle. You're watching the landscape turn from green to gold over those 7 weeks, and the offerings map directly onto what's happening in the fields.
Which makes me wonder, why wheat for the Shavuot offering? If barley is the first grain, the one that breaks the hunger gap after winter, you'd think that would get the premium slot. But it doesn't. Wheat gets the finale.
Wheat was the premium grain. Deuteronomy 8:8 lists the 7 species of the land of Israel, and wheat is first. Wheat flour is finer, the gluten structure is better, the bread is lighter and more pleasant to eat. It was also more labor-intensive. Barley is tough. It grows in poorer soils, needs less water, matures fast. Wheat requires better land and more care. So wheat became associated with prosperity, with abundance, with divine blessing. Offering wheat at the temple was giving your best.
Barley is the workhorse. Wheat is the show pony.
And you see this hierarchy all through the biblical text. The Shtei Halechem are the only leavened grain offering in the entire temple calendar. Leviticus 2:11 explicitly says all grain offerings brought to the altar shall be unleavened, no shemitz. But the 2 loaves of Shavuot are shemitz, leavened, risen, full. That's a deliberate contrast with Passover, where you eat matzah, the bread of haste, of affliction, of not having time to let dough rise.
Passover says you left in a rush. Shavuot says you've arrived.
You've arrived, and the land is yielding its fullness. The leaven represents completion. The grain cycle is done. You can take your time, let the dough rise, bring the finished product to God. It's the culinary equivalent of exhaling.
Like the difference between packing a go bag and setting a dinner table.
And that brings us to the second part of the question. What were people actually eating? Because the temple ritual is one thing, but the daily bread of an Israelite farmer is another.
So the 2 loaves are wheat, waved before the altar, eaten by the priests. But if you're a farmer in the hill country of Judah in, say, the 8th century BCE, what's on your table?
And we know this from archaeology, not just from texts. Excavations at Tel Es-Safi, that's biblical Gath, and Talbatash, biblical Timnah, have turned up grain storage facilities where barley and wheat were kept together. In Iron Age, two strata, which covers roughly the period of the monarchy from about 1000 to 586 BCE, barley makes up 40 to 60% of the grain remains, sometimes more in drier regions.
We're talking about a society where the majority of calories from grain came from barley.
Wheat was aspirational. Isaiah 55:2 has that line. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? The word lechem there can mean bread generally, or food generally, but in context, the prophet is talking about people chasing after luxuries. Wheat bread was a luxury. Barley bread was what you ate.
If I'm an average Israelite farmer, and I show up to my neighbor's house, and he's serving wheat bread, I know something's up. Either it's a wedding, a festival, or he's showing off.
You know he's either celebrating, or he's climbed the social ladder. And you'd notice immediately. The color is different. Barley bread is darker, more grayish brown. Wheat bread is lighter, more golden. The texture is completely different. A barley loaf is denser, flatter, more crumbly. You can spot the difference across the room. It's like the difference between a rough wart tunic and a dyed wool garment. Both are clothing, but nobody confuses them.
It's almost a visual class marker baked into every meal.
Literally, baked in. And think about what that means for social relations. When you break bread with someone, you're revealing your economic position. There's no hiding it. If you're a tenant farmer and your landlord invites you to a feast, you sit down, look at the bread on the table, and you know exactly where you stand.
There's a great example in Judges 7, Gideon's dream. A Midianite soldier dreams of a round barley loaf tumbling into the camp and destroying a tent. Barley bread is a symbol of the Israelite forces. The dream works because barley is the common man's food. It's the grain of the masses.
In 2 Kings 4:42, Elisha feeds 100 men with 20 barley loaves. That's a miracle story, but the grain choice isn't random. Barley is what's available. The same thing shows up in the New Testament, John 6:9, the feeding of the 5,000. The boy has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. By the first century, it's still the staple.
What about eating them together? Barley and wheat in the same loaf or the same meal?
That's where Ezekiel chapter 4 comes in. Ezekiel is told to make bread from a mix of wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. It's a siege ration. God tells him to bake it over human dung, though he's allowed to use cow dung instead after protesting. Not exactly a recipe card for the ages, but it shows that mixed grain bread was known. During hardship, you stretch the wheat with whatever you have.
The Ezekiel bread at the health food store has really cleaned up its sourcing since then.
But the point is, barley and wheat were eaten together, just not equally. If you had wheat flour, you might cut it with barley to make it go further. If you only had barley, you ate barley. The social gradient was clear. The priestly class, the royal court, wealthier landowners, they had wheat bread. Everyone else had barley, with wheat appearing on special occasions.
Which makes Shavuot interesting, because it's a wheat festival for a barley-eating population.
The holiday celebrates the wheat harvest, but the average Israelite farmer who's making the pilgrimage to Jerusalem for Shavuot has been eating barley flatbread for the past 11 months. The two loaves in the temple are aspirational. They represent the best of the harvest offered to God. They're not what you're having for dinner.
The festival is almost a proxy. You bring your first fruits, you watch the priests wave the wheat loaves, and that's the community's wheat moment. But you go home and grind barley.
This is where the destruction of the temple in 70 CE changes everything. Once the temple is gone, you can't bring the Shtei Halechem. You can't wave the Omer. The entire agricultural ritual apparatus collapses. Shavuot loses its physical anchor overnight.
What does it become?
This is one of the most remarkable pivots in Jewish history. The rabbis, faced with a festival that no longer had a ritual mechanism, reconnected it to the Torah's own chronology. They calculated that the revelation at Sinai, the giving of the Torah, occurred on the 6th of Sivan. That's exactly the date of Shavuot in the post-temple calendar. The earliest explicit connection appears in the Makilta de Rabbi Ishmael, a 3rd century midrash. By the time of the Mishnah, the transformation is complete. Shavuot becomes Zeman Matan Toratinu, the time of the giving of our Torah.
That's a rebranding for the ages, from grain festival to revelation anniversary.
It saved the holiday. Without that pivot, Shavuot might have faded into a minor agricultural footnote, like the biblical harvest festivals that other ancient Near Eastern cultures had and lost. Instead, it became the occasion for all-night study for the reading of the Book of Ruth, which, notably, is set during the barley harvest and wheat harvest, a vestige of the agricultural layer, and eventually for the dairy meals.
The dairy is its own whole thing. Where does that come from?
Multiple explanations, none of them biblical. One tradition says that when the Israelites received the Torah, they now had the dietary laws and realized their meat wasn't kosher, so they ate dairy. Another connects it to the description of Israel as a land flowing with milk and honey. A third points to the Song of Songs, which is associated with spring and has imagery of milk and honey under the tongue. But all of these are medieval. The dairy is a custom, minhag, not a commandment.
The cheesecake is a Talmudic aftermarket add-on.
The cheesecake is a beautiful aftermarket add-on. I'm not knocking the cheesecake.
Neither am I. I'm just saying, if you time-traveled to the court of King David and said, Shavuot, nobody's handing you a blintz.
They're handing you a barley flatbread with some olive oil and maybe a handful of olives. And they're looking at you strangely because Shavuot for them is a pilgrimage to the sanctuary, not a dairy buffet.
Let me pull this together. The biblical Shavuot is a wheat harvest festival built on a barley counting calendar. The Omer, barley, starts the clock at Passover. 7 weeks later, the wheat is ready, and you bring 2 leavened loaves to the temple. That leaven is the whole point. It's the anti-matzah, the bread of completion. But the people bringing those loaves are barley eaters. Wheat is for God and for the wealthy. And then the temple falls, and the rabbis perform a theological rescue operation that turns a grain festival into the anniversary of Sinai.
That's the Ark. And you can still see the agricultural skeleton inside the modern holiday. The counting of the Omer, we still do that, 49 days every year. Most Jews who observe it think of it as a spiritual preparation for receiving the Torah. But the structure is pure agriculture. You're counting the grain harvest. You're tracking the ripening of the wheat.
Which means that even now, even after 2,000 years of reinterpretation, the Jewish calendar is still tethered to the growing season of the land of Israel. You can't escape the barley.
You can't escape the barley. And that's actually a lovely thing. It means the holiday retains, deep in its bones, a connection to the physical world that most modern religious observance has lost. Pentecostalism has the spirit. Shavuot has the soil.
The soil and the spirit. There's a sermon in there somewhere.
I'll leave that to the rabbis. But let me add one more layer to the grain hierarchy. Barley wasn't just the poor man's food. It was also animal fodder. In 1 Kings 5:8, when Solomon's court is provisioning the royal stables, barley and straw are listed together for the horses. So barley occupies this dual role. It's human food for the masses, animal feed for the elite. Wheat never gets fed to animals. Wheat is exclusively human food, and ideally human food for people who matter.
If you're eating wheat bread, you're signaling that you're not livestock.
You're signaling that you're not livestock and you're not poor. It's a double status marker, and this is why the Shtei Heleshtem being wheat matters so much. You're not offering God animal feed, you're offering the best.
That's a striking image when you think about it. The temple altar is a table set for a divine guest, and you're putting out the good bread, not the horse bread. It's hospitality logic applied to theology.
And hospitality in the ancient Near East was serious business. If a guest arrived at your tent, you didn't serve them barley unless that was truly all you had. You brought out the wheat flour you'd been saving. You killed the fatted calf, or at least the fatted kid. The temple ritual is essentially divine hospitality. God is the honored guest, and the 2 wheat loaves are the best seat at the table.
Which raises a question about what we reconstruct when we talk about biblical eating. If you're trying to eat like an ancient Israelite, going heavy on wheat is actually getting it wrong. You'd be eating like a priest or a king.
If you want to eat like an average Israelite in the first temple period, your bread should be mostly barley, maybe with some emmer wheat mixed in if you're having a good year. Your protein is pulses, lentils, fava beans, chickpeas. Your fat is olive oil. Your sweetener is date honey, not bee honey, which was rare and expensive. Wine is for special occasions. Water and maybe sour milk or yogurt are your daily drinks.
The biblical pantry is leaner than the modern kosher cookbook would have you believe.
And seasonal in ways we've forgotten. Shavuot is a dairy holiday now, but in biblical terms, late spring is actually when dairy production peaks. The animals are grazing on fresh green pasture, the kids and lambs are nursing, there's a milk surplus. So the dairy connection, while it's a later rabbinic development, actually maps onto the agricultural reality of the season. The rabbis may have invented the reasons, but they didn't invent the seasonality.
That's a good corrective. The custom isn't arbitrary, it's just got a different root system than the one people assume.
And that's what makes this whole topic so interesting. Shavuot is a palimpsest. You've got the agricultural layer, the temple ritual layer, the rabbinic reinterpretation layer, the medieval custom layer, and now the modern revival layer where people are trying to reconnect with the land. You can read all of them at once if you know what you're looking at.
Let's talk about that modern layer. You mentioned baking a barley wheat blend. What would that actually look like?
If you want to approximate a biblical era loaf, you're looking at a ratio of maybe 70% barley flour to 30% wheat. Barley has less gluten, so a pure barley loaf is dense and crumbly. It doesn't rise much. Adding some wheat gives you enough structure to hold together. The flour would have been stone ground, so it's whole grain. None of the sifting and refining we do now. You'd mix it with water, maybe a pinch of salt if you had it, and bake it on a hot stone or in a clay oven.
Or would they have had a sourdough starter?
Sourdough is ancient. We have archaeological evidence of sourdough starters from Egypt going back 4,000 years. The Israelites almost certainly maintained a starter, a piece of dough saved from the previous batch, full of wild yeast and bacteria. That's how you leaven bread before commercial yeast. So yes, your biblical loaf would be sourdough, whole grain, mostly barley, baked on a stone. Nutty, earthy, slightly sweet from the barley, denser than modern bread. Barley has a distinctive taste. It's got more soluble fiber than wheat, which gives it a kind of creamy texture when cooked. In bread, it's heartier. If you've ever had a dense German Vollkornbrot or a Scandinavian flatbread, you're in the neighborhood.
How does that actually work in practice? If I'm in my kitchen this week and I want to try this, what's the step-by-step? I'm not working with a clay oven, presumably.
You're probably not, unless your kitchen is very authentically appointed, but you can approximate it. Get stone ground whole barley flour and whole wheat flour. You can find these at most health food stores or online. Mix 70% barley to 30% wheat. If you're maintaining a sourdough starter, use that. If not, you can use a small amount of commercial yeast. It won't be strictly authentic, but it'll get you close enough for a first attempt. Mix the flours with water and a pinch of salt. The dough will be stickier and less elastic than pure wheat dough because of the lower gluten. Don't expect it to double in size like a modern sandwich loaf. Let it rise for a few hours, then shape it into a flat round. Think more pita or focaccia than boule. Bake it on a preheated pizza stone or a heavy cast iron skillet in a hot oven around 450 degrees Fahrenheit. You want a good crust on the bottom.
You're eating this with olive oil and olives.
That's the classic accompaniment. Maybe some za'atar if you want to get regional. Some fresh goat cheese or labneh if you're honoring the dairy tradition. A few dates on the side. That's a meal. An Iron Age Israelite would recognize immediately.
You mentioned the 70-30 ratio. Is that fixed, or would it have varied?
It would have varied enormously by region, by year, by household. In the drier parts of Judah where wheat struggled, you might be eating 90-10 or even pure barley. In the more fertile valleys where wheat thrived, maybe you could push it to 50-50. The 70-30 is a reasonable average for what archaeology suggests was common. But there was no standard recipe. You use what you had.
Which is itself a very biblical approach to cooking. The idea of a fixed recipe with precise measurements is a modern cookbook convention. Ancient cooking was entirely responsive to what was in the storehouse.
And that's part of what's lost when we try to reconstruct these things. We want a formula, but the reality was more like a practice. You knew your flour, you knew your oven, you knew how the dough should feel. The variation from household to household, village to village, would have been significant.
This Shavuot, someone could bake a 70-30 barley wheat sourdough, serve it with olive oil and olives, maybe some fresh cheese if they want to honor the dairy tradition, and they'd be eating something that an Iron Age Israelite would actually recognize.
And I think there's something powerful about that. Most Jewish holidays have become disconnected from their agricultural origins. Sukkot is still a harvest festival if you squint, and Tu B'Shvat has been revived as an ecological holiday, but Shavuot is still mostly cheesecake and all-nighters. Reconnecting it to grain, to the actual substance of the harvest it celebrates, that's a kind of retrieval that doesn't require rejecting the rabbinic tradition. It just adds a layer back.
You're not undoing the cheesecake. You're putting bread under it.
Literally and metaphorically.
Let me circle back to the question Daniel asked. Would barley have been enjoyed alongside wheat? The answer is yes, but with a clear hierarchy. Barley was the daily staple, wheat was the festival grain and the luxury good. They were eaten together in mixed loaves during hardship, and they were stored together in the same granaries. But nobody was confused about which one was premium.
That hierarchy is built into the temple calendar itself. The Omer is barley, humble, early, the first thing ready. The Shtei Halekim are wheat, premium, late, worth the wait. The festival structure encodes the agricultural and social reality.
Which means Shavuot, in its original form, isn't just a harvest party. It's a theology of grain.
A theology of grain. I like that. The land gives what it gives in its proper season. You don't rush it, you don't demand wheat in March. You watch the barley come in, and then the wheat. And when the wheat is finally ready, you bring the best of it to God, leavened, full, complete. That's a spiritual discipline built on agricultural patience.
It's a discipline we've almost entirely lost. Nobody counts the Omer by walking their fields anymore. But the calendar still works. The barley in Israel still ripens around Passover. The wheat still peaks around Shavuot. The land hasn't changed.
The land hasn't changed. And that might be the most remarkable thing about this whole discussion. You can go to Israel in May, stand in a wheat field in the Jezreel Valley, and see exactly what an Israelite farmer saw 3,000 years ago. The same grain, the same season, the same sun. The theology has evolved, the rituals have transformed, but the agricultural substrate is still there.
That's almost a kind of continuity that's rarer than we think. Texts get reinterpreted, rituals get reinvented, but the growing season doesn't care about theology.
The growing season is the one thing the rabbis couldn't reinterpret. They could change what Shavuot meant, but they couldn't change when the wheat ripened.
So, what do we tell someone who's observing Shavuot this week and wants to engage with this older layer?
A few things. First, read the Book of Ruth. It's traditionally read on Shavuot, and it's set during the barley and wheat harvests. Ruth gleans in Boaz's barley field, then the story culminates at the wheat harvest. The agricultural setting isn't background. It's central to the plot. Reading it with an eye to the grain cycle changes how you understand the story.
I think a lot of people miss that when they read Ruth. They focus on the loyalty, the romance, the lineage to David. But the whole plot is structured around the harvest calendar. She arrives at the beginning of the barley harvest, and by the time she and Boaz have their rooftop scene, it's the wheat harvest. The story is tracking the same 7-week arc we've been talking about.
It's the same 7 weeks. Ruth chapter 1 verse 22 says they arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Chapter 3 verse 2 has Boaz winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Then by chapter 3 verse 15, she leaves with 6 measures of barley, a gift that's also a signal. The whole narrative is embedded in the grain cycle. It's not just set dressing. Bake the bread we talked about, a barley wheat sourdough. 70-30, whole grain, stone ground if you can get it. Eat it with olive oil and olives, maybe some goat cheese if you want the dairy connection. Taste what a biblical loaf actually tastes like. Count the Omer. Even if you're not religious, count 49 days from Passover to Shavuot. Watch the spring unfold. Notice what's growing. The Omer count was originally an agricultural practice, and you can reclaim it as a mindfulness exercise. What's ripening in your life? What are you waiting for? What's worth the full 7 weeks?
That's almost suspiciously poetic for a donkey.
I contain multitudes.
To wrap this up, Shavuot starts as a grain festival. Barley opens the harvest, wheat closes it. The temple gets 2 leavened wheat loaves, unique in the entire sacrificial system. The people eat barley year-round. The temple falls, the rabbis pivot to Sinai, and the grain gets buried under layers of dairy and study and custom. But the calendar still tracks the harvest, and the land still does what it's always done.
If you want to taste what that original festival was about, the ingredients are still available. Barley flour, wheat flour, water, salt, olive oil, a sourdough starter. 3,000 years of history in a loaf of bread.
Which leaves me with one open question. If Shavuot had stayed an agricultural festival, if the rabbis hadn't connected it to Sinai, what would Jewish identity look like today? Would we be more connected to the land? Would the exile have broken the holiday entirely? Or would it have evolved into something else we can't even imagine?
That's a counterfactual that could fill an entire other episode. My instinct is that without the Sinai connection, Shavuot would have become a minor folk holiday, maybe preserved by communities that stayed on the land, but largely forgotten in the diaspora. The rabbinic pivot didn't just save the holiday, it made it portable. You can study Torah anywhere. You can't wave wheat loaves in Babylon.
The portability of revelation versus the rootedness of agriculture. That's the tension.
It's a tension that runs through all of Jewish history. But for now, we've got a festival arriving on Thursday, and we've got a chance to taste the older layer. That's worth something.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and this has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It genuinely helps. We'll be back next week. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1970s, researchers in Belize discovered that certain epiphytic bromeliads in the Maya Mountains deliberately trap and drown insects in their water-filled leaf wells. Not for nutrition, but to create a nitrogen-rich compost tea that feeds the entire microecosystem living in the plant's canopy. A behavior that makes the bromeliad less a passive reservoir and more an active farmer of its own miniature pond.
The plant is running a nitrogen farm.
With a body count.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.